Tonight's talk is simply titled The Path. One hears from time to time the word path used in connection with Buddhism. I myself have likened meditators to travellers and have mentioned that you are all spiritual travellers journeying along a path. But what is the path that is being referred to here? One hears about the Eightfold Path in Buddhism. Is it that? Or is it perhaps the path of Streamwinner? Or the path of Once Returner? Or the path of Non-Returner? Or the path of Arahant? Path here means the way that leads directly to Nirvana. And it includes the paths of Streamwinner, Once Returner, Non-Returner, and Arahant. It can help if one imagines the spiritual path as a physical path which winds its way up a mountainside. The mountain is very large and very high and has many different types of terrain that you, the traveller, have to journey through. Sometimes the ground is steep and rough and difficult to traverse, and where the hardships of the journey are so great that you are tempted to abandon the whole idea of climbing to the summit. At other times, the path winds through delightful meadows where cool, crystal clear pools are shaded by tall, slender trees, tempting travellers to put down roots, settle, and enjoy the beauty of the surroundings, and forget all about completing the journey. Traveller here refers to you. Travellers who climb actual physical mountains have to have certain qualities, such as stamina, drive, determination, courage, and sheer guts, if they are to reach their destination, the top of the mountain. Likewise, you, the traveller along the spiritual path, need the self-same qualities as the mountain climber if you are to reach Nirvana, the top of your spiritual mountain. And it is no easy task, because just as physical exhaustion is what can prevent a mountain climber from continuing his journey, what stops a spiritual traveller dead in his or her tracks is doubt. Doubt saps the energy and prevents further travelling, as surely as physical exhaustion cripples the mountain climber. One of the rather sneaky aspects of doubt is that it has a subtle side to it, which one doesn't expect to be there, and so one doesn't notice its presence. In its grosser form, doubt is easily detectable. The spiritual traveller is aware of it, and being aware of it, he can choose to find an antidote and get rid of it. But in its subtler form, it goes quite unnoticed, and so wreaks havoc, because the meditator, being unaware of its presence, doesn't put a stop to it. Before I explain what the subtler forms of doubt are and give you examples of them, let's just talk a little more on the subject of the path. This path, which I've likened to an actual path up a mountainside, which has certain difficult patches and certain pleasant areas, both of which have to be travelled through but not succumbed to, relates in Buddhism to the paths of Streamwinner, Once Returner, Non-Returner, and Arahant. Although traditionally these paths are described as four separate paths, they are not in fact different paths. Rather, Are they four separate sections on the same path? So the path of Stream Winner can be likened to the first section of the path up the mountainside. Once returner to the second section of the path, non-returner to the third section, and arahant to the fourth and final section, which leads directly to the summit, in other words, to nirvana. In addition to picturing yourself journeying up a mountain path with all its attendant difficulties, you have also to imagine starting your journey at the bottom of the mountain with an enormous number of goods strapped to your back. You are carrying such things as a piano, a pair of hedge clippers, a football, a chimney pot, a plant, a standard lamp, and a sofa. Things which are of no possible assistance to your journey. In fact, they are a definite hindrance, wearing you down, exhausting you, and making it impossible for you to travel through the narrow ravines and up the steeper sections of the mountain. These goods have got to be got rid of if you are to reach your destination successfully. The piano, the hedge clippers, the football, and everything else that you have strapped to your back are a simile for the 10 fetters which you carry around with you on your spiritual journey, and which are useless items. They are items which do not help your quest in any way at all. They only hinder it. These fetters have first to be detected and then let go of if you wish to be successful at journeying up that path to the summit. These useless items called fetters are doubt, attachment to rule and ritual, belief in a self, sensuous craving, hatred, craving for fine material existence, craving for immaterial existence, conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. A favorite question of meditators is, am I on the path yet? To answer the question, am I on the path yet? The majority of you here tonight are either working to get onto the path, or you are on the first section of the path. Those who are journeying along the first section are technically termed meditators who are on the Stream Winner's path. Only a very few of you have completed the first section and are journeying further up the mountain. To get onto the path and to complete the first section is the most difficult part of the whole journey. The problems which bother the meditator on the Stream Winner's path are exactly the same problems that bother those of you who are not yet on the path. In other words, doubt, attachment to rule and ritual, and belief in a self. These are the problems that the majority of you will have to face time and time again until you have learnt how to recognize them and how to handle them without any movement of the mind for or against these problems. The person who has doubt also has attachment to rule and ritual, and attachment to the view of self. These three problems are linked. You cannot have one without the other. This may come as something of a surprise to some of you, for you may well recognize that you have plenty of doubt in your mental makeup, but would regard yourself as far too sophisticated to be attached to rule and ritual. That's for primitive tribal people, surely. Isn't attachment to rule and ritual, when a person is convinced that by bowing down before a stone carving of a Buddha 100 times a day, every day, that that act alone will result in his becoming enlightened? Well, yes, that is attachment to ritual. But ritual has a much deeper side to it, and I hope to reveal that to you tonight. If the question is not, am I on the path yet? Then it's, where am I on the path? Usually, the meditator receives a non-committal response from the teacher, which is interpreted either to mean that they are just about to become enlightened, or if the meditator is feeling a bit negative, it's interpreted as, I'm a million lifetimes away from even getting on the path. The truth, as usual, lies somewhere between these two extremes. The question that so often follows on the heels of, am I on the path, is how long does it take to travel to the end of the path? How long it takes you to get onto the path, then to complete the first, second, third, and fourth sections of that path, is governed to a very large extent by your past actions. If in the past you have spent much time and effort devoted to the religious quest, then your spiritual journey will be quick and smooth. And by the past, I mean not only the immediate past, but your past lives as well. Let us say that it takes 50 lifetimes of devotion to the religious quest in order to become enlightened. Now, don't take that figure seriously. I've made it up. I don't know whether it takes 7 lifetimes or 57 lifetimes to become enlightened. All I know is that it definitely takes more than one lifetime. So 50 is just a convenient round number. Let us say it takes 50 lifetimes from the time you decide you want to overcome suffering and become enlightened to the time that your goal is reached. In each of those 50 lifetimes, you spend considerable quantities of time meditating, studying religious texts, and listening to wise discourses. Maybe you've even had a try at ascetic practices, like eating only a few grains of rice a day, or standing on one leg staring into the sun. Perhaps you spent hours spinning prayer wheels on some remote snow-capped mountain in the Himalayas, believing that that activity is exactly the right one to loosen you from the bondage of suffering. One thing is for sure, however, and that is that all of the different practices would have been undertaken because you sincerely believed that they were the ones that led directly to the highest of the high, enlightenment itself. You go through one lifetime after another, discovering that this or that particular practice doesn't get you where you want to go. Then you discover a practice which looks as if it will get you to the summit of the mountain, provided you follow its tenets in the correct manner. Let's say it's meditation that you decide holds the key to all the answers, and specifically Vipassana meditation. Once you've discovered meditation, you spend several more lifetimes practicing it. And some of those lives are spent as a monk or as a nun. Eventually, it dawns on you that certain qualities of mind, such as faith and investigation, are not sufficiently developed within you for you to make the necessary headway with the meditation, and that this lack is temporarily blocking your journey up the mountainside. Having made this discovery, you now spend a few more lifetimes developing the qualities that you are currently deficient in while still continuing to meditate. It is impossible to predict the length of time it is going to take you to complete the spiritual journey. So much depends on the work you've done in previous lives. Some meditators are only on their 10th life. So for them, the whole of the spiritual endeavor is a bit of an uphill struggle. But for those who are on their 47th life of dedication to the religious ideal, understanding the teaching comes easily, as does spending much time practicing meditation and associated disciplines. For such people, there is a great love of the spiritual way and everything to do with it. There is no shortcut for anyone. Everyone has to do the same amount of work. Everyone has to go through each of the 50 lifetimes and learn what they are supposed to learn in each one. If it looks as if a fellow meditator is advancing faster than you are, it only means that they did at some earlier time the work that you are now doing. And you can't opt out and say that because it looks as though it's going to take me lifetimes of work, I think I'll sit this life out, thank you very much. You can't opt out because you have to do the work at some stage or other, as the whole purpose of existence is to come to understand through direct seeing that you create your own universe. And therefore, you create your own suffering. This understanding can only come about through the spiritual training. If you put off the spiritual training to a later date, then, when you eventually do get down to it, it is even more of an uphill struggle. Provided you work steadily and evenly at the training, it gets easier and easier as the years go by. If you work in jerks, stopping and starting, the training becomes a continuous battle. Should you ever feel like getting the sulks and giving up because you can't become enlightened right now, and it looks like it's too much work, well, do pause and consider for a moment how fortunate your conditions are. You've found a way, you found a couple of guides, you have sufficient wealth to allow you leisure time, which you can use for meditation and study. You have your health, thus you can travel to lectures and hear the Dhamma, and you can come on residential meditation courses. If you were sick and confined to bed, attending lectures and residential courses would be out of the question. Reflect on the fact that in a future lifetime, conditions may not be so fortunate for you, so it is best to make full use of them whilst you've got them. There are two popular and opposing beliefs in Buddhist circles. One is that it takes many lifetimes before one can become enlightened. The other is that the task can be done in this very lifetime now. Those who think it takes many lifetimes, say that it is not possible to become enlightened in just one lifetime. Those who believe that it can be done in this very life say that that view is nonsense. They say that if we are already enlightened, then all we have to do is open our inner eyes and merge with what is right under our nose to realize nirvana. As it so happens, both these views are correct. One view does not contradict the other, provided one looks at both of them from a slightly different standpoint. It does take many lifetimes of working at the religious, mystical way in order to become enlightened. But if this is lifetime number 50, then it is one's last lifetime. And so enlightenment is going to happen in this very lifetime. How do you get onto the path? If already on it, how do you get through the first section? You get onto the path and you get through the first section by letting go of attachment to doubt, rule and ritual, and the view that you are a separate and discrete self. Let's look at each one of these fetters and define their obvious and not so obvious meaning. Doubt means to doubt the spiritual discipline you have chosen to follow. You doubt that it is effective. You doubt that it leads to what it says it leads to. You doubt that Buddhadhamma leads to enlightenment. This fetter also means that you doubt the ability of the guides you have chosen to lead you. You doubt that they know the way to the top of the mountain from their own experience. If you are confident that they do know the way to the cessation of suffering, you doubt that they understand you sufficiently to help you get there. Or if you are confident that your guides are fully experienced, you doubt your own ability to become enlightened. You doubt, too, that there is any value to be gained in spending lots of time meditating, or going on retreats, or spending a longer period still at the practice by becoming a monk or a nun. How often have you done an hour seated practice, after which you sighed and said, "Well, that was a waste of time, wasn't it? A whole hour of torture, and for what? This meditation is just too difficult." To you, the period was a complete waste of time. You might just as well have spent the hour enjoying yourself, with your feet up, watching the television. If you've ever made a statement like that, you've experienced the fetter of doubt. To put those doubts into perspective, consider the following. How many of you can drive a car? Were you, the very first time you got behind the steering wheel, an instant Stirling Moss? No, you only became a skilled driver because you got into that car and you practiced and practiced and practiced at your driving skills. If you had dwelt at all on the doubts and the frustrations that beset you whilst you were learning, you wouldn't be driving around the streets today. You would have abandoned your attempts long ago. The same goes for the spiritual training. If you take any notice at all of your doubts and frustrations, at best, you will prevent yourself from getting anywhere, and at worst, you will abandon the practice entirely. If you give up in the middle of a seated practice, because the meditation is not going the way you want it to, at that instant, you have abandoned the meditation. You have abandoned tamma. You have abandoned your climb up the mountainside. All because you have fallen prey to the fetter of doubt. You fell prey because you could not let go of those doubtful thoughts. You just had to act on them. And until you have mastered the capacity to note, but not take any notice of doubtful thoughts, you stop yourself from journeying along the path. It is only a temporary stoppage, because you invariably pick yourself up the next day and start again. But each time you handle doubtful thoughts incorrectly, you sap your energy, you damage your joy in living, and you make the whole of the spiritual training that much more of a battle for yourself. When a meditator consistently applies too much effort to his practice, he is instructed to spend the following hour of meditation doing nothing, but just sitting and watching, and to abandon returning the attention to the rise and fall and the counting. He is told he must spend the hour doing nothing. For a while he's happy. He's enjoying doing nothing. It seems like a bit of a holiday. But then the mind starts to wander and daydream and fall asleep. From the meditator's perspective, nothing seems to be being achieved by following the instruction to sit and do nothing. It all seems a waste of time. At least, when turning the attention to the rise and fall, he was doing something. He was going places in his spiritual training, even if it was accompanied by a headache, which he believes is a small price to pay as long as he's getting somewhere. So what does he do? After about 15 minutes of following the teacher's instruction to do nothing, he abandons that and returns the attention to the rise and fall. That meditator, by his actions, shows doubt. He doubts the teacher. As far as he is concerned, the instruction the teacher gave him was useless. He can't see that following the instruction leads anywhere worthwhile at all. So he abandons it and returns to concentrating on the rise and fall. He believes there's something intrinsically more worthwhile about the rise and fall than about sitting doing nothing. Bear in mind that at this stage he doesn't know anything about the path, because he hasn't been along it yet. He doesn't really know what will be gained by paying attention to the rise and fall. He just believes it leads somewhere, because he was told in the far and distant past that it was a worthwhile thing to do. He's lost sight of the fact that it was a teacher who told him what was a worthwhile thing in the first place. This meditator, by applying too much effort in the meditation, was actually going down the wrong Eightfold Path. To stop him from continuing down the wrong path, the teacher changed the instruction and would have kept him on the new instruction until he had gained sufficient experience of what was too much energy and what was too little. Once the meditator had gained this experience, the teacher then would have changed the instruction again, and perhaps got the meditator to return to concentrating on the rise and fall, knowing that by now the meditator had more understanding of energy, so he would not travel down the wrong path quite so frequently. But the meditator could only have gained the experience of the difference between too much and too little energy by carefully following the teacher's change in instruction. The example given shows clearly the fetter of doubt. But how does attachment to rule and ritual and self-view relate to the same example? The meditator insisted on practicing a former instruction, the one of continually returning the attention to the rise and fall. And by that action, he showed both attachment to rule and ritual and self-view. Let me explain. A meditation technique is only effective if it is right for that person at that moment in time, with the supporting conditions that exist at that time. If a teacher changes the instruction, it is because the meditator and the conditions have changed. If the meditator insists on continuing with a past technique, he is effectively saying that he has not changed. And declaring that he stays the same is self-view. Insisting on staying glued to the rise and fall at all costs, even when told not to, shows an attachment to a previous rule. There is a belief that there is something intrinsically magical and worthwhile in the rule of pay attention to the rise and fall of the abdomen. If the meditator didn't have that attachment to the rule, then he would be quite happy to follow the teacher's new instruction, would he not? How do you overcome doubt, rule and ritual, and self-view? You overcome them by letting go of them. But also, you overcome them by developing their opposite qualities. The opposite of doubt is faith. The opposite of rule and ritual is adaptability. The opposite of self-view is conditionality. There are 101 ways in which a meditator can show doubt. Perhaps you read a book on Tamma, and finding a technique described in that book which you haven't heard about before, but which looks good, you decide to give it a try. Perhaps the technique described is open your eyes slowly after a period of meditation, or else keep your eyes open slightly when meditating. So you do just that. Your teacher hasn't told you to practice in that fashion, so why do you do it? Why must you follow what you read in a book? Why must you follow past instructions? Instructions from previous teachers? Instructions you make up yourself to help you cope with painful practices? Why can't you just take the instruction that is given and practice that, and only that? You can't do it because doubt is still a part of your mental makeup. A meditator has been meditating for years, and at the end of every course, he asks this following question: what should I do with my meditation over the next few months until I next see you? His question shows that he is both doubtful and attached to rule and ritual. Why does he not just continue with the last instruction? Why does he doubt that the teacher isn't giving him the latest up-to-date information on his meditation, and that he has to keep checking up to make sure that his teacher's on the ball vis-a-vis his personal instruction? Why does he need to be given further fresh instruction, in other words, a rule, in order to feel safe? Another meditator is told not to join in the 3 hours of group meditation that morning, but to go and work instead. He explains to the teacher how he could fit in the work and the meditation. By his actions, He shows that he doubts that the teacher has his spiritual welfare at heart. Because surely, the more meditation he does, the more he increases his chances of becoming enlightened. So how can the teacher be so uncaring as to ask him to give up his seated practice for that day? The meditator also shows attachment to ritual, the ritual of seated meditation. He secretly believes that the summit of the mountain can only be reached through seated meditation. He ignores all the teachings he's heard, which say that he must learn how to meditate while sitting, standing, walking, lying down, and attending the calls of nature. Attachment to rule and ritual breeds a rigidity of mind. The person wants to stay doing the same thing, even when the conditions change. When a teacher detects this rigidity, he will give instructions that involve the student in changing direction, thus forcing him to let go of his cherished routines and become more adaptable. Adaptability is the opposite of attachment to rule and ritual, and thus will weaken this fetter. In order for the student to carry out the teacher's instruction at all requires faith and devotion. Until a meditator has got through the first section of the path, he is going to be constantly plagued with doubts and attachments to old routines. Although superficially it will look as if the meditator is carrying out the instruction, he will be subverting it and hanging on to his own idea of the way he should be treading the spiritual path. The meditator sincerely believes that he is doing exactly what the teacher has told him, but in fact he is fooling himself. So how do you overcome this catch-22 situation, where it seems that you are constantly deluding yourself until you have got through the first path? You overcome it by developing devotion. If you have sufficient faith, then even though you don't want to spend an hour just sitting doing nothing, and everything in you screams to abandon the instruction and return to concentrating on rise and fall, you won't be able to do it. You have so much faith that the teacher knows what he or she is talking about, and that there is something to be discovered by following the instructions, that the pull to go in the direction of the teacher has instructed is greater than the pull of doubts and attachment to past routines and the pull of your own view of the way it ought to be done. Recently, a Bulgarian couple were motoring through Germany when their car broke down. The husband said he'd go for help, and he told his wife to stay in the car. 3 days later, he returned. His wife was still sitting in the car in the lay-by. And the husband's explanation for taking so long to return? He'd forgotten where the car had broken down. This is reported to be a true story, and the radio commentator who told it was most fascinated by the wife's devotion to her husband's instructions. My teacher, Kapalawado, said that if his meditation teacher had asked him to climb to the top of a very high building, open the window, and jump out, he would have done just that. The most difficult thing that his teacher did ask him to do was to sit and meditate until he returned. His teacher went off, leaving him to sit cross-legged on the floor. 24 hours later, he returned. Kapalawado had not moved a muscle in the whole time. Several monks had to carry him away and massage his limbs because his legs had developed cramp and he had sat solid in the one position. That is the depth of devotion you need if you wish to be successful at walking the path and reaching the summit of the spiritual mountain.